Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the resident show stat guy.
It has been a slow week because of holiday season, obviously, and we hope that all of you had a wonderful celebration. As we prepare to transition into the next set of volleyball seasons, we wanted to dive in to see what has been going on in the transfer portal, answer some listener questions, and have a little bit of fun after the craziness of the NCAA women's tournament with some of Adam's games.
My favorite.
Let's get started.
So the major buzz around the volleyball world currently has been what is going on in the transfer portal as the NCAA season has wrapped up. We've been following along and taking a look at what's happened, so we're going to break this down into a few different sections as we get into it. So we'll have biggest news, and we'll talk about some specific players, what's happened, and then we'll talk about the biggest program poachers and the biggest losers. It really makes you wonder why so many people left a program. So let's get started and hop right in.
Keep in mind, the biggest news is like biggest news according to Adam and I. So not everybody will agree, or we probably missed something that you think is very important. But in our research, these are the things that popped out.
So let's start with Purdue, who had a pretty good season. They've lost four players. So both starting outsides, a starting middle, and their opposite have all left. Clearly something is going on in that program. We don't have the details, but you have Eva Hudson and Lizzie Carr both going to Kentucky. You have Chloe Chicoine heading to Louisville, and Lourdes Meyer is still uncommitted. But that's a lot of players to lose.
That's a lot of starters to lose. So their setter, Anderson, I believe she was just a sophomore. Raven Colvin obviously was a senior. I'm not sure what class their libero was in, but you're looking at potentially five remaining starters and four left.
So that to me strikes as something's not quite right with the program or in the locker room. Normally, you don't see so many starters leave after a successful year.
I mean, Sweet 16, then they got trounced by Louisville.
That's a fair point, but for Purdue, given the athletes that they have, I think that they finished about where they should finish.
Yeah, and I feel like if you commit to Purdue, you're...
You understand where you are.
You would think, like, they're not a top five program. So I'm very curious as to what is happening, not to mention their assistant coach left midseason last season. So something is in the water in Purdue. Very interesting stuff. What do you think about Eva Hudson going to Kentucky and Chicoine going to Louisville?
I think that's a case of both of them believing they're better than the program.
Or thinking, or like being like, no, we want to win. Peace.
Yeah, that's definitely possible.
But that goes back to my question of like, what did you think you were getting into in Purdue? Like, if you had made an Elite Eight, is that better?
Well,
Purdue is not a Final Four type of program consistently. They might have a year here and there where they're really good, but like, I don't think they're like the perennial Final Four type of team.
Oh, I think that's an accurate assessment. I think a lot of players now with the transfer portal who maybe aren't top recruits go, I'm going to go to a decent program. I'm going to play 1 year and get recognized. And then I want to go to a Nebraska, a Kentucky, a Final Four edge team. And they're not willing to stay and help build a program. There's no loyalty. I mean, we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, so I'm not going to get into it, but I think that's the case.
Both Louisville and Kentucky lost senior outside, so they're essentially being given an opportunity to walk in and earn a spot. So, I don't know. I have very distinct opinions about the transfer portal. We'll get into it. Another very interesting move, in my opinion, was the starting setter for Texas, Avery Carlson, entered the portal. Now, she went to Texas from Baylor and then was part of the whole 6-2 situation that Texas had going on, and actually won out the 5-1 spot when they made that switch in October or November. Yeah, I'm sorry. You're not going to transfer once, but twice. Oh my gosh. Okay. Texas lost 5 players total, which honestly is not, that's not the shocking part to me, because they just like stack their roster. And of course, everybody thinks they're going to be a big star at a top program. And then when they're not, they're like, bye. The shocking part is that they have not picked up anybody from the portal yet. And they are usually scooping. They're usually waiting until a shock athlete comes out and then just like tries to snag them in Nebraska.
So I have a thought about picking up players from the portal from a coach's standpoint that we'll get into later, but I think it might be in effect here.
Oh, you're going to keep us hanging. Okay. Very curious about that. Looks like Ella Swindle's got her job back.
I mean, the setting in Texas was a question mark all year. You come out on top. I don't know whether it's just you're losing hitters and you don't think you're going to be successful, or didn't get along with your teammates after everything that happened, or the coach told you you're playing a 6-2 again after you won the spot. Like, there's so many things that it could be there, but it is surprising. I agree with you.
Or maybe she just thinks that they're going to suck. They lost Rutherford. They lost Skinner. They lost Wennis, I believe. I mean, okay. So many issues are coming up that I do not like, but okay.
This one makes me really sad.
This one hurts, yeah.
Ohio State lost 4 players, including Emmy Selman, who's going to Penn State, and middle blocker Eloise Brandway, who is going to Creighton. Now, you and I talked about this a few times on the podcast. I thought Ohio State had an incredibly bright future. I enjoyed watching them. They had a ton of young players. You could see them put strings of points together and see, man, they're going to be so good when they mature and kind of figure it out and find some consistency. And I know they had some bad losses, and it's never easy to go through a season, you know, where you probably want to win more games than you do. But that core could have been something special, in my opinion. And for them to jump ship this early for greener pastures, this to me is the major problem with the portal.
And it's, for me, the major problem with young athletes today. Yeah, this one was very disappointing to me. I have so much respect for a coach who's willing to build a program from the ground up and who won't just cop out and take more developed or experienced players to have an easier path to success. So I was so excited when I saw this roster earlier in the season. And yeah, were they good? Not really, but they had moments of brilliance. And so I really believed that they would be able to build something, and to see this, it makes me so upset for Jen Flynn Oldenburg, because like, what do? You do all the right things and there's no loyalty.
I feel for the coaches in these situations for sure.
Miami is losing 6 players. 1 is a grad student, but they're 2 biggest point scorers in Grace Lopez and Flor Marie Heredia Colon. Lopez is going to Wisconsin and Colon is currently uncommitted. That is going to decimate that program.
And this is another program that had some really good wins this season. They had some big upsets against ranked teams. They were fun to watch play. I don't understand.
It's not going to be good down in Coral Gables, let me tell you. Those 2 scored so many points for that team. And we talked about how bad their serve receive was. Like, so those 2 were hitting a lot of out-of-system balls. That's got to hurt.
Yeah. I hope that they're able to pick up a couple players from the portal and just keep it going, because that's, like you said, it decimates the program. You have to start over, essentially, when you lose players like that and you're not expecting to.
And here's the thing for me is, like, I'll use these 2 players as an example. It's like, yeah, you are a star at Miami. basically, like, you were the go-to players. You came up big in some big matches. Like, you were the stars. And I think, and I don't want to say that this is what their thought process is, but the impression that I get from a lot of athletes who maybe aren't in top programs or, you know, are on the bench at a top program or something is just like, no, I'm better than this. Like, look how good I was this year at this program. Like, I can for sure play for a top 10 program or whatever. And it's like, not everybody is cut out for that. And like, maybe you are a big fish in a medium-sized pond here, but like, you're about to be in a big pond.
Grace Lopez is going to struggle in the Big Ten.
I don't think she's a Big Ten opposite. I do not.
I mean, look who you're putting her up against in what division, and you are going to have to score against great blockers and good defenses night in and night out. This is the dichotomy for athletes where you think you're A, but really when you play against great players night in and night out, you're B. And the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. And switching programs to learn that lesson hurts a lot of people, I think.
It's a completely different set of expectations to be on a Wisconsin versus a Miami. It's just fact. When you are at a top program, the expectations are different.
Speaking of Grace Lopez going to Wisconsin, Wisconsin lost both their backup DS / liberos. Guchtekin is heading to Tennessee and Damaro is off to Creighton, which is kind of surprising given that they both saw playing time this year due to injury. I'm kind of scratching my head with this one, wondering if it's just about playing time or if there was some losing a lot of players in the dressing room, not sure where it's going to go, thinking they're not going to play. I couldn't quite reason my way through these two.
For me, it's one of two things. Either you graduated your entire roster pretty much and you're like, we're going to suck, I'm getting out of here. Or the writing is on the wall and you want to play and you know with a current freshman libero, you're probably not going to. My question to Creighton is, did you watch any matches that Wisconsin played when Damaro was the libero and how many times she got ace? Like, did you watch?
Yeah, but she's going to be great in that division. She for Creighton during the season is going to be just fine and probably exactly what they need. If they go deep in the tournament, though, and she has not settled into looking at Big Ten serves, it's going to be tough for Creighton, I think. Bet on yourself, I guess.
Finally, Aya Elnaty from Kansas is heading to Northwestern. And I need somebody to clarify this for me, because how are these grad students still able to play? Like, have they not used up 4 years of eligibility? Like, I am so confused about this. I thought Elnaty was a senior. I thought she played all four seasons. Maybe I'm wrong. But it's like a question I have in general is like, I thought the extra year, like with COVID and stuff, was done now.
I mean, this is academic reasons, I have to imagine. Northwestern has a very good academic reputation.
No, but I'm saying, like, how is she able to go play there?
No, I understand that. The rules don't make sense to me at this point either. I thought the COVID years were also done.
Are the COVID years done? Are they allowed a fifth year still? Because, like, I don't get it.
This one I have no problem with. She graduated. She wants to do a master's. It's a great school. She can keep playing.
All right. On to the biggest poachers. I don't think anybody is going to be shocked to hear that SMU has already picked up 5 players from the portal, continuing their streak of recruiting almost exclusively from the portal. Jaden Livings and Favor Anyanwu from USC and Malaya Jones from Colorado State are their biggest pickups so far. But I'm sorry. If I'm a parent, or if I am a high school student athlete getting recruited by SMU, I'm like, no thank you. Because clearly, you are incapable of developing your own athletes. Last year, their entire roster was grad students taken from the portal, and now they're continuing the same thing. Like, red flag alert.
Yeah, and I think from a coaching standpoint, when you start at a school, you have to go through your recruiting class, pulling in portal players make sense. You want to build your name. You need to have some success to recruit players. But at some point, you have to trust your own ability to develop, to recruit, and to put a winning product on the floor. And SMU had a great regular season last year. They were polished. They beat some good teams. But there is something to be said about playing with athletes for more than 1 year when the chips are down and things get tough. And you saw that in the tournament. They underperformed. And you can't blame it solely on having transfer players, but I think that's a big factor.
Well, with such a huge turnover all the time, like, how are you supposed to develop a consistent team culture? How are you supposed to develop a consistent team identity? Like, in the past, you would be in a program, most players would stay in the same program for 4 years, and as the young players came in, they were taught, you know, this is what we do, this is who we are, this is what the team values. And like, sure, you make tweaks to it every year, but when you're having a complete, you're cleaning house every year, how do you establish like what your program is, like from an identity and culture perspective? It's no good.
And I will say, from a coaching standpoint, you help shape the culture, but you need your senior athletes who have been with you for 3-4 years, who understand what you want, to be a voice in the room for you. You have to develop those relationships. I don't care how good of a coach you are. It's a symbiotic relationship with your senior players. And, you know, you come in as a freshman and you got a little swagger and you got a little attitude and you want this. And sometimes you need a vet to sit you down and say, listen, kid, this isn't how it works. And every top athlete has gone through that experience, and you need it. It's part of your development.
I don't know. I'm going to stick by it. Like, prove to me that you know how to coach. Prove to me that you know how to, like, build a team and develop players, because right now I'm not buying it.
We see Auburn following in SMU's footsteps. They lost 2 athletes this year but picked up 6. Be interesting to see how they do next year.
They're like, ooh, look at what this did for SMU. They were ranked all season. They were the only team to beat number 1 and 2 seeds, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's do it. Let's don't do it. And finally, Creighton didn't lose anybody to the portal, but they snatched up 3 athletes, including Eloise Brandwee from Ohio State and Sage Damro from Wisconsin, as we talked about earlier. Yeah, they did some stealing, not sharing.
Well, and the other thing for the portal for me is, and there's no way to regulate this, and I totally understand. It's one thing if a player reaches out to you and says, hey, can I come play for your program? It's another thing to actively try and grab athletes, in my opinion. And I know there's no right or wrong, or there's no way to police that, but that's just a personal philosophy, I would say.
No, we're not saying that Creighton did this, but I was surprised because they have had, obviously they've taken transfer players in the past, but they've been steadily rising year over year, and yeah, interesting.
So Florida State loses 6 total players, 1 grad, including their starting libero, Emery Dupes, and their starting setter, Kenna Felon. Dupes is heading to Pitt, and Felon is heading to Illinois. The majority of their starters were seniors last season, so that's maybe not shocking.
I don't know. I mean, 6 is a lot. Because then you have to think, like, okay, maybe those 6 would have stepped into the starting role. So now is the starting role not enough? And now you need to be a part of you need to be a starter on a successful team? Well, guess what? Positions are limited. So I'm not shocked that the 2 remaining starters chose to leave, but I am surprised about the other ones. Something is in the water in the rest of these places, because these schools were just burning athletes. Like, they're like, see you later. Virginia Tech lost 7. Memphis lost 8. That's like almost a whole team. Charleston Southern lost 7. Cal State Fullerton lost 7. Rider lost 6. Georgia State lost 6. Marshall lost 6. Old Dominion lost 6. There's a problem here.
Well, for some of those lower-ranked schools, I think athletes use it as a stepping stone as well. Now, losing a whole roster is one thing, but I think there's probably a mix of, I think I can play for a better program and maybe something going on with the team.
And then the last one that we're going to mention that might be something that we haven't talked about yet is that San Jose State lost 7.
For those people who haven't been following what's happening, San Jose State had a transgender athlete playing for them.
Who I believe is going to be a senior this coming season. Don't quote me on that, but I think maybe.
And there was a lot of talk, a lot of controversy, as this is kind of an ongoing issue in...
Well, and a lot of teams forfeited.
Yeah.
Against them.
So it's a tough situation to navigate. I would imagine it's even harder for the athletes and the coaches and the athletic staff at San Jose State. So it'll be interesting to see if they can feel the team, if people are willing to play there, and how that is going to play out.
Like, we are not going to weigh in with our opinion on the issue at all, but I can see the fact that so many teams forfeited against them is probably incredibly frustrating. Like, as a young athlete, you want to play, you want to compete, and to not be able to because, I mean, of choices and value systems and beliefs from different programs. Like, that was probably tough for a lot of the people on that team. So, yeah, that one was interesting.
Obviously, the transfer portal is still open for a little bit of time, and there's another transfer window in the spring, but this is what we've seen so far. We will keep our eyes on this as other things develop, as players commit. We'll try and keep you guys updated on what's going on.
We're going to dive into some listener questions now. We have answered some here and there in recent episodes, but we wanted to have a section where we just answer a whole bunch. So thank you to everybody who submitted questions or have been engaging with us on YouTube and social media. The first one is, what are your thoughts on NIL and the transfer portal, and how do you think you would have interacted with them as a student athlete? Simple answer, I hate both of them.
Well, I think it's a little more nuanced for me. I have no problem with NIL for the athletes. I think college sports makes a ton of money. I think that the athletes, they are getting a free education. I totally see the value in that. But if somebody wants to sponsor them and they want to use their social media or whatever else they have to generate a little revenue for themselves, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't like buying players to go to colleges, which is something that is happening with the NIL. So I think there needs to be some guardrails around that. But players who are good and who have a presence and who can monetize that should be able to. That's my stand on the NIL.
Maybe my distaste for the NIL has to do with me missing out on the NIL. I'm not bitter at all. Don't worry about it. I think, you know, so many college athletes are making more than pro athletes. And for me, that's an issue. I think it is fine within reason. I just think it has gone to these extremes. And at the end of the day, like, some of these are kids and they are very young adults. Like, trust me, I understand that I went to a school where student athletes are put on a pedestal. I am fully aware of that. It is unfair when, to Adam's point about schools buying players with NIL money, like, it just creates such a big discrepancy. Back when there were strict scholarship limits, it was just a really sneaky way to, like, avoid it. And I don't like it. Like, when I was a student athlete, I valued education very much. And so for me, knowing how expensive an American post-secondary education is, I felt like it was a fair trade. I felt grateful that I was being given an opportunity to get an education and leave college debt-free in exchange for my skills as a volleyball player. I felt like that was fair. But I understand that not everybody has the same values as I do. So from where I'm standing, it's really hard for me to get behind NIL because I know what is important to me, but it's not like that for everybody.
Transfer portal.
I hate it. I think it is killing college sports. I think, you know, with the transfer portal, it is a microcosm of what we have seen in just this generation of athletes and of human beings in general. It's just, obviously, there are scenarios where a transfer is necessary. Back when I played, there were people who transferred. It didn't happen nearly as much as it does now, but it did happen. And that's very personal to individual athletes. But I think when it becomes a me thing, I think we've completely lost the essence of what it means to be on a team, what it means to be resilient and to work hard, what it means to be loyal and do what you say you're going to do. I think there are so many big pieces that are completely thrown away with how easy it is to get out of a situation. And I feel like college sports used to be such a pure thing where you are going to battle with your closest friends, people that you are experiencing the transition into adulthood with, and you're there for each other. You are not making money. You're doing it for the love of the game and for the love of each other. That loyalty is gone. And it makes me really, really sad. I know my college experience was different than most in that I came in and started day one as a freshman. So am I completely qualified to have these opinions? I don't know, because I did fight for my spot, but I didn't have to sit on the bench. So I don't necessarily know how that feels. But knowing who I am, if I was on the bench, I would use that as motivation to get better and to earn the spot. Because then it becomes so much sweeter when you know that you've worked hard to achieve something that you want. And that's the danger and the gray area of sports is like, you want to play. That's human nature. You want to be on the court. You want to play. But then having that inter-squad competition of pushing each other and making each other better and being happy for your teammates' successes while also pushing for your own personal ones, like, it is such an interesting balance. And I think we're completely losing that as athletes become so much more me focused. And I will give a shout out to Kennedy Orr from Nebraska, because here is a setter who is obviously very good. She was recruited by Nebraska and she sat on the bench her entire career and she stayed and she was a teammate. And because, you know what, like, sure, seven players get to have the spotlight on them on game day, but those seven players don't get better without the seven that they're competing against every day. And for her to stay, despite never being a starter, like, that is a teammate to me. That's what being an athlete and being on a team means.
And I think from a coach's perspective, it makes things much more challenging. Sometimes you have to look at your athletes and tell them that wasn't good enough, or have hard conversations, or push them into uncomfortable places at practice for them to get to where they want to go. And now I can only imagine, as a college coach, you're thinking, if I push too hard, is this athlete going to leave? Are they having fun? Do they like me? You know, all of those things. And don't get me wrong, there needs to be a balance. It's not a dictatorship. But the fact of it is, as a coach, you're developing the player and the person, and sometimes they're not going to like you. That's you doing your job. And I think with the ease of transferring now, you have to walk a very thin line in terms of making your players happy, but also trying to push them to be better. And I think that that is probably incredibly difficult.
Adam and I know a young athlete at a top program. She is not a starting player. And we heard from this player that their coach basically only works with the starters, or the people, the eight people who consistently play, and does not engage with the other players at all. And it's shocking to hear that as an athlete, because my instinct is, well, doesn't he want to develop the athletes to replace the ones that are going to be lost to graduation? But then it's also like, why? But I can understand in this day and age, why would this coach waste his time on the players who aren't playing? Because they'll probably leave anyway. Like, that is how messed up this whole thing is. You've just completely taken away the best parts of being on a team. So, Adam, another question we got was, what is the difference between an outside hitter and an opposite hitter?
That's a great question. So, generally, there are two outside hitters. They play on the left side of the court, and only one opposite because they're in the position with the setter. And so, 90% of the time, you will see the outside hitters passing and hitting. And so the two outside hitters, regardless of whether they're in the front row or the back row, along with the libero, generally form the core of your passing team. And then they also hit when they're in the front row. The opposite is generally your point scorer. They're usually your biggest athlete with the heaviest arm, and they may or may not have the best ball control. Their primary responsibility is to score points and generally get you out of trouble. They hit a lot of high balls. They hit a lot of out-of-system balls. They generally have a very good serve. It's your quote-unquote power player.
And then if you hear the term pin hitter, that is like an all-encompassing term for the outsides and the opposites because they're the two hitters that hit near the antennas.
If we're talking about player stereotypes, generally outside hitters, you have two different types. One who can score you more points, and then another one who maybe has better ball control. So you very often see the better ball control outside hitter and the libero passing, you know, three quarters of the court, and then another outside hitter passing a sliver. There's different ways that teams can build with outside hitter strengths and weaknesses, but that's the general overview.
The next question we got is, would you like to see more parity in the NCAA game? This is a very good question. And I believe the person who asked this was getting to the essence of, if there is more parity, you will see the stronger teams kind of take a little drop in their level while the lower ranked teams increase theirs.
I think when you talk about parity in terms of the team's competition level, you're always going to have teams that are at the top and teams that are at the bottom. There's not a whole lot you can do about that. You're going to have some coaches who get the best out of athletes at this age and some who don't, or maybe better suited for a professional or a club team. And so there's no real way to facilitate parity in my mind, because you're always going to have groups of good athletes who want to go and do something special together.
Well, and I think the pre-NIL days were as close as you would get.
I would agree.
To that being a reality, because when you look, like, there are so many factors that go into an athlete selecting a school. And there are so many different things that are important and not important to different people. So certain programs have, you know, given themselves a reputation of being a great place to play volleyball, but maybe somebody doesn't want to travel that far from home. Or, you know, maybe somebody doesn't want to live in that city or state, or they value their education and it just won't work out. Like, there are so many pieces that go into it. So I don't think there ever really is truly parity. I personally am fine with the level being the way it is.
I would say the one interesting thing, being relatively new to following college volleyball closely, if you build your program in a mid-major division and you become very competitive, I would have loved to see Creighton play in the Big Ten, in the ACC this year, because they dominated their league play. They had however many games of not really being pushed or challenged. How good could Creighton have been if they got to hone themselves against the best teams for that part of the season? That, to me, is something that would be potentially interesting and create a little more parity. I know logistically it doesn't work, but when you talk about parity in the game, that's something that comes to my mind, having followed this season relatively closely.
Or maybe instead of just preseason cross-conference play, there's like this random tournament in the middle of the season. So you can see the teams like at close to top form going head to head and just see where they fall, because so many of those matches happen during the preseason or the NCAA tournament. Like, there's no in between. People are either trying to figure things out or it's crunch time. So that might, it would be interesting to see like a tournament partway through. But I think another thing to remember is, like, I know we've talked a lot about the transfer portal and people wanting to be a big fish in a big pond and win and start and things like that. But I think not everybody wants a big college experience. For a lot of athletes, like, getting the opportunity to still be part of a team is enough. And I know we have kind of taken it to the extreme when we've been talking about the transfer portal, but, and not every athlete is like that, but it's like some athletes know that they have no future in the sport after college. And just the opportunity to set themselves up for their future and get their education paid for, or be a part of a team for another 4 years, like, that is enough. So I think if you bring the parity discussion into it, you would lose so many of those types of kids. That was a very long way of saying, no, I don't want to see more parity in the NCAA.
So somebody asked, and I thought this was a great question, what are some of the most challenging places to play?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I could answer this now. It was a long time ago that I was in college.
Rattle me off your top five.
Oh gosh, I don't even know if I could give you five. Okay, I think Nebraska is challenging in the sense of it's overwhelming for people who don't experience that day in and day out. I remember my first red and white game. It was the inter-squad scrimmage when I was a freshman, and that was the first time I had played in front of that many people, and my legs were shaking. I was like 17 and my legs were like shaking, and it was a scrimmage. So if you're coming into an environment like that and they have like tens of thousands of people, even though it's not a hostile environment, unless you're Wisconsin, no, just kidding. Even though it's not a hostile environment, it's intimidating for somebody who doesn't see that. So there's that. I think the meanest fans when I played were from Missouri.
Really?
I hated playing at Missouri. They were so mean. They were great hecklers, and like looking back, like they were really good burns, but like they were mean, and Texas was mean. Those were probably the two words. Oh, I heard BYU is, I think BYU leans heavily on their fans. I think BYU is probably a tough place to play too.
Looking at just some of the matches and facility wise and where it would be challenging, I think the elevation in Colorado would be tough to play in. I also think the super low ceiling in Miami. If you're used to playing in a really big gym and you're digging high and you're looking visually at all of the space around you, going into that closed environment would take some getting used to.
Playing at elevation is no joke.
So I think that we've hit the majority of questions that I've seen on the channel so far. If we haven't answered your question, please send us a message on YouTube. I'll be looking for them, and we'll continue to aggregate questions as the episodes go on, and we'd love to hear from you.
And we have answered some on YouTube too, so if you didn't hear yours, check your YouTube comments to see if there's been a reply. But thank you so much to everybody who took the time to write into us.
All right. Coming up in January, we have both Love and the PVF starting. PVF will be in their second season, and Love is starting with their inaugural season. Sarah and I looked through all of the rosters for all of the teams that have been posted thus far, and why don't you give me your impression of who's playing in the league, what it's going to look like, you know, what people can maybe expect going into these seasons?
To be honest, I have no idea what to expect here. I went through all of the rosters of both leagues. For Love, you have, you know, the founding athletes, which are current or recently retired national team athletes.
Big profile athletes.
Big profile athletes, big Team USA, you know, history there. So I think you're getting a wealth of skill and experience and professionalism from that core group. And there's one to two on each Love team. We couldn't find anything about foreigner limits for Love. It did seem like there were a lot of foreign athletes. What we're seeing is foreign athletes who are kind of on the tail end of their career. Looking through the names, I played against a lot of them, you know, early in my pro career. And I thought they were on their way out when I was.
We won't mention any names.
But they're not. So you're seeing some international experience, some foreign professional experience, but a little older. And then you're seeing new young talent. We'll get into the quote unquote love six, as they're calling them here shortly. But you have another group of athletes that I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way, but they have very big social media followings, but maybe have not been in the volleyball world or in the volleyball spotlight in recent years. Does that adequately sum it up?
Yeah, I think that adequately sums it up. And I mean, let's be fair. These leagues are brand new, and starting something is difficult. And I think having a professional league in North America is a great thing. Are you gonna?
What about having three professional leagues in North America?
But this is how things start, right? And that's okay. You're not gonna get the big international stars. You're not gonna pay enough for them. You're not an established league. People don't know what they're getting into. You have many things you have to do in this first year. You want people to follow you. So the social media presence, it does make a difference. You need to put people into the stands. You want to continue to develop your college level athletes for people who may not want to play overseas or may not be good enough to do that yet. You want them to be able to stay in the States. I get that. So it's an interesting dichotomy of, like you said, young players who are inexperienced internationally, who haven't been professionals, and then people who have probably done and seen it all. So it makes sense that they would start in that way, and hopefully you start to groom the next layer of professional athletes, given the experience that you have, for the athletes who, let's be honest, you get to a point where you don't want to leave and live overseas anymore, and now they get to pass their knowledge and experience and continue to play in a setting that's more comfortable to them. So I think the way the rosters are constructed make a lot of sense for where the league is. Is it going to be the best professional volleyball? Probably not. And there's going to be some growing pains, but hopefully it's good enough to be entertaining.
I'm very curious what the level will look like. I understand that, you know, you're not going to get the big names to come right now. The money's just not there. There's no reason for those players to leave Asia and Europe. But like you said, you have to start somewhere. I found it very interesting. I don't know if it was transparent to everybody, but how obvious it was that they were looking for social media, like followings. It's very clear that they want to get the word out there. And I'm just so curious how those contracts were negotiated or what those conversations were like. Because it's basically like, we want to use your platform, but you will not play.
Maybe they will play.
And if some of those players do play, I will be on the floor. Like, I'll be shocked. Yeah, it's a bold move. It's a genius move from a business standpoint, from an eyeballs on the product standpoint. But like, yeah, I'm curious how this is all going to pan out. Just quickly before we get into the Love Six, the PVF rosters, PVF is allowed two foreign athletes per team. They have been very transparent about their pay structure. I don't know anything about the Love pay structure. So that is a question mark that I have. Like, how much are some of these American, like, Olympians giving up financially to do this? Or has Love made it worth their while?
It would be a very interesting question to get answered.
I am very curious. The PVF rosters, I will be honest, I think PVF is based on the rosters. It's a great opportunity for people to play after college. Looking at the names, I think Love will be a higher level than PVF. Can I say that with certainty? No, I'm just going based off of...
Give us a month. We'll have a more in-depth opinion for you after watching a few matches.
Straight up looking at headshots and names and like who I know versus don't know, I think Love will be much stronger. But, you know, it's cool that these athletes have an opportunity to be professional volleyball players and make money playing volleyball.
I'm very curious to see how the different leagues function, what the production value is, what the entertainment value is, what the level of volleyball is. It's going to be an interesting 2 months. I'm looking forward to seeing what product gets put on the floor and how it is shown to the public.
Let's get into the Love Six. So Love has signed six graduating seniors that we saw play in the 2024 NCAA season. They have sent one athlete to each team. Those athletes are Sophie Fisher from Georgia, Lexi Rodriguez from Nebraska, Sarah Franklin from Wisconsin, Jess Merzik played at Penn State, Madison Skinner played at Texas, and Onye Ofegbu from Oregon. I think of all of these players, Madison Skinner has the brightest future professionally. Lexi Rodriguez as well. I think her skill set is solid and it's good for her position, obviously. But it's just a different game. And I think that Skinner's skills will translate to the international style of play better than the other ones.
All right, it's game time. And in honor of the Final Four wrapping up in the NCAA women's season, I thought it would be fun for you to pick a semi-all-star team, but there's a caveat. Okay. So I've gone through, and for each position, I've selected three athletes. And you have to pick who you would choose for your team and why. And for everybody out there, she has no idea who I've put on my list. I've picked players to make it interesting, but most of them are top-level players. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
We haven't done one of these games in a while. I'm very excited.
I mean, we've been watching 20-plus matches a week, so it's been a little busy. So this is actually fun. All right, here we go. Starting at the setter position, your three options are Fairbanks from Pitt, Stark from Penn State, or Waite from Creighton.
This is harder than I thought it would be, actually. I'm going to go with Izzy Stark from Penn State. The reason I say that, I think that Rachel Fairbanks has some incredible hands. I think the way she runs the middle off the net is great. She has made some spectacular plays that I have seen, but in critical point matches, I have seen her crumble. That is a red flag for me. Izzy Stark was a freshman, and I saw her in a couple different matches look terrified and look like she did not believe in herself, but I saw her rally and I saw her dig deep and pull herself out of whatever dark place she was trying to crawl into and deliver. And her out of system setting, the way that she is able to run an offense, I think her future is very bright. I think she puts up a solid block. There are way more upside pieces to Stark than there are negatives. And I think her upside outweighs the other ones. So, yeah, Izzy Stark.
All right. At the libero position, we have Rodriguez from Nebraska. We have Scott from Louisville. And we have Grimes from Penn State.
This one is really hard. Give me a second. I had to take a break and think about this one for a minute. I'm back. I would go with Elena Scott. I know there are probably so many people out there who are like, you are absolutely insane, but hear me out. From a serving perspective, I think they're a wash. I don't think either one of the two is a particular prolific server.
I know what's going to tip the scales in Elena Scott's favor, but continue.
From a setting perspective, I think Elena Scott is an outstanding setter.
That's what I think tipped the scales in her favor.
I'm not saying Lexi Rodriguez is a bad setter. She's pretty good. But when the chips are on the table, she did not set well in that semifinal match against Penn State. It's true. Go back and watch the tape. From a passing perspective, Lexi is a very good passer. They're both very good passers. I would say Lexi's probably a more solid passer than Elena Scott is. Defensively, I think they are both outstanding, but I will say I think that Elena Scott digs down the line better than Lexi Rodriguez does. And I saw Elena Scott make better adjustments in critical moments than Rodriguez did. Let the comment, keep them coming. I want to hear your comments. I know you're probably mad at me. I love it, but that's who I'm picking.
All right, the first group of middles is Cressy from Louisville, Jackson from Nebraska, or Francis from Stanford.
Andy Jackson.
I knew whatever list she was on, you were going to pick that.
No, I mean, I think both Francis and Cressy are great blockers. If anything, they might be better blockers than Jackson is, but offensively, there is absolutely no comparison between those athletes. And if I am taking a little bit of a dip in the blocking category, I'm more than making up for it offensively. So, Jackson.
Colvin from Purdue, Kelly from Pitt, or Alec from Nebraska?
I would pick Bree Kelly from Pitt. I think Raven Colvin's strength is her blocking, but I think Bree Kelly is a pretty solid blocker as well. Like, maybe I'm taking a little dip from Colvin in a blocking sense, but with good passing and a setter who can deliver, I think Bree Kelly is much more efficient from an offensive perspective.
For your first left side, you have the choice of DeBeer from Louisville, Murray from Nebraska, or Para from TCU.
Oh, it would have been so interesting to see Para play with like a solid team around her. I think from a passing perspective, all three are pretty similar. I know people are going to be mad about that too. I don't care. Para's passing is probably a little worse than the other two. Defensively, I think she's better than the other two. She reads the game so well from a defensive perspective. Her serve is substantially better than the other two. Oh, this is just so hard because Para had to do everything for her team. And she was like very successful at it, obviously, but like she hit her limit. She was maxed out. I'm gonna cause a ruckus here and say Para. I think if she had a solid team around her, she would be able to score with so much more ease. And mixing in her serve and the way she reads the game, I think it's great.
All right. Your second left side position, you got Stafford from Pitt, Mrzek from Penn State, or DeLay from Kentucky.
I'd take Tori Stafford. I think she passes better than the other two. I think, you know, she has been part of a good team, but her hitting percentage is outstanding. The way, how fast she gets off the ground. She's a versatile attacker. She plays good defense. Man, you are setting me up to just be ripped apart by people.
I purposely made the choices difficult. I wanted to see
it's
and
a no
hear
win.
Your thought process.
Like, no matter who I pick, there are going to be people like, how dare you? So it's a lose for me.
All right. And last, we're going to go to the opposite position. I purposefully left Babcock off the list because I knew you would just pick her no matter what. So to make it interesting, we've got Jura Vicious from Penn State. We've got Kennedy Martin from Florida and Anna Smrek from Wisconsin.
Kennedy Martin. It's not, that might have been the easiest one. I think, again, she gets every ball for Florida and still scores and is still effective. I think she's a much better attacker than the other two. I think, you know, she actually plays six rotations, which can't say that about the other two. She actually serves. No, not even close.
All right. Well, there it is. That's your pick a player. And I thought that
I'm sweating.
I'd make you sweat a little. That was the goal.
Literally sweating as I'm like stressed out about these answers. Some of those were very hard. But for all of you who are going to be critical, like, put your biases aside and like, I'd be curious what you would actually think too.
Well, I would be, so throw your teams up on YouTube. Let us see. Let's have a conversation. I would be curious what people think. I know we've had a lot of very intelligent comments on YouTube from some serious volleyball fans who watch a lot of college volleyball. So I would be curious to get other opinions.
It was a little more laid back this week, kind of like a fun housekeeping week, if that is a thing. Can housekeeping be fun?
No.
Okay. But yeah, hopefully you guys are as excited about the new American Pro Leagues as we are, just to see what the level is, see how they function. Hopefully they are very viewer friendly because the NCAA did a great job this season in, you know, making those games accessible. We are actually going to be off next week as the leagues kind of get started. We roll into things. So we wanted to wish you all a very happy new year. Thank you so much for being part of the start of this podcast with us. We have so much fun doing this together and sharing our love of volleyball with all of you. Yeah, so don't expect anything from us next week, but we'll be back the following week with an update on how love is going. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.